Hour 3, Triple Option with RBKD. Kept on waiting for the lyrics to come on your right. This is just instrumentals.
Oh, BK smart.
Picture me rolling.
So we can all keep our jobs.
Yeah, this is a fantastic song, though. He is very smart. And this is Way Back Rap Wednesday. So we appreciate all y'all who've been listening, chiming in as well. Get to hornfm.com if you want to check out any of the shows, including this one. And get the Horn app. It'll make life a little bit easier for you as we continue to talk, of course, college football. 87 days away from Texas and Louisiana. That's going to be a tough opener here in Austin. And the Longhorns, obviously, really just a lot of questions about Sark and kind of where this program is right now. This has not been a good decade for Texas. And now we're getting all those magazines that are coming out. I'm still waiting for the Bible. Now, the Bible to me, and I think to a lot of us, is Phil Steele. And I don't believe that is out yet. But Athlon, remember back in the day, it was Athlon, it was Lindy's, it was Street and Smith, and a lot of those have really gone downhill. I think we were just so thirsty and hungry for it back in the day.
Exactly.
You didn't have the TV coverage, you didn't have the radio shows.
Social media wasn't what it was now.
There weren't many outlets, weren't many avenues to actually find it, so you weren't as critical of what the actual product was, but those Athlons and those Lindy's, maybe they've rebounded a little bit, and I've still bought them, even though I know that it's not Phil Steele and not as good, but they don't seem to have the same cachet like they used to.
No, they don't, but all of those companies still do release preview magazines every year. Now, I think Bucky is the only person who buys the Street and Smith.
Street and Smith, when I was a kid, was great, and then I remember the year I got it and thinking, oh, you guys just don't care anymore, huh?
I won't lie to y'all, I'd never heard of Street and Smith until I had met Bucky.
Really?
And he's reading this college football preview magazine, and it's called Street and Smith. I figured it was two of his Texas cheater buddies who just gotten together to make a college football preview magazine. But apparently, it could be a big deal.
Bob Dunn was all about it. I know in the Athlon and the Lindy's back in the day, they would have cheerleader sections.
Ayo.
Like the hottest cheerleaders.
Oh, I remember that.
Can you do that anymore?
I don't know if they
do. You should be able to, but can you?
Remember Playboy at one point used to have the college editions.
Oh, yeah. We have one in here, the Big 12 one.
They would have like the Big 12
fantastic
edition. Yeah. People love those. But I know. Not politically correct these
there
days.
There are pages missing. blame the Saturday guys or Bucky for that.
Pages were
stuck together.
Yeah.
I knew you were going there.
I wasn't going there.
That's exactly where you going.
I wasn't going
don't,
there.
Don't tee it up and then back away from it, okay, Rod? We know we all listen to the show. We know who has the dirty mind.
I was going to figure out a different way around it, all right? A different tact, if you will.
I just gave you a tack right there.
I just went right at it.
Show prep. Show prep.
That's exactly what it is. All right, so we talked about this earlier. Athlon did have an anonymous coach who talks about the Texas job and diminishes the Sark hire, and it just felt very absolute. I think that was our takeaway at 3 o'clock. BK, I'll send it to you here, though, because I thought you had some really good points on this. This is a cocktail that has a lot of different things going into it. Pretty much the coach said it's all about the culture.
Yeah.
And it's nothing to do with scheme and, as you pointed out, player development.
Yeah, so here's the exact quote. It's an anonymous college football coach who mentioned this to Athlon Sports.
Head coach, do we know that?
Head coach.
Okay.
And this will appear in Athlon Sports' National College Football Preview magazine as a part of the Texas Preview page. The exact quote, there are a ton of questions here long term. Why make this move? It doesn't seem like you're doing anything fundamentally different. Texas's problems are all off the field and inside their culture, and I'm not sure this is the coach who can fix issues that only Mack Brown seemed to know how to handle, end quote. You're right. You can't be absolutist here.
You just can't.
There are a number of issues that have plagued the Texas football program for the last decade. But to me, the biggest issue is not a culture thing, and it's not an off-the-field thing. It's player development, and that happens on the field. Now, developing players, of course, happens in the weight room and in the film room.
So there can be four or five branches below that.
For sure. But on the field, development has been the biggest problem for Texas. They've recruited well. The facilities are fine. They've hired some good assistant coaches over the years. They've hired coaches who have been successful at other places over the years. But the biggest problem, the biggest consistent problem that we've seen from Texas through 2.25 coaches now, I'll say the last fourth of the Mack Brown era, is player development. They're getting talent. They're not turning them into NFL early-round draft picks, and they're not developing them at the college ranks to where Texas is able to compete for conference championships. So to say that all of Texas's problems are all off the field and inside their culture, I just think, Rod B., that is completely inaccurate.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it's multifactorial. There's a lot of layers to it. And, you know, the problems that Texas had when Mack Brown left, or, you know, during Charlie Strong's time where they couldn't even make bowl games, the troubles they had then, they're different than the troubles they have now. I think back then, Texas had third world problems. Quarterback hell they were in, offensive identity crisis, offensive line recruitment and development in shambles, a lot of coaching turnover, tons of coaching turnover with the assistants as well.
Soft entitled players into that.
No, I'm with you on that too. Even the administration behind the scenes, right? A lot of turnover with the president, with the athletic directors at the time, and a lot of division behind the scenes as well. You don't have that now. Now it seems like Jay Hartzell and Chris Del Conte and Kelvin Eltife and the powers that be, the BBs, are starting to get back into the box. At least they're all aligned in their vision and their support for one another. That wasn't even the case with Chris Del Conte and Tom Herman were here. Mm-hmm. They weren't even aligned. All right, so just last year we had issues there. I think they're in a better place when it comes to that. So I think now Texas has more first world problems as opposed to 6-7 years ago. They had some third world issues going on, and we all saw that the cracks that really were hard to see in the late 2000s there, but they were still starting to surface, even though you really couldn't see them because Colt McCoy was here and he was able to really kind of cover up a lot of those issues Texas had. They started to come to the forefront when you lost that type of leadership. So I think, yeah, I think there is some substance to what was said there by that anonymous coach, but also a lot of nuance that's missing from that point. All right, there's a lot of layers to it. So, like I said, Texas has first world problems now. Quarterback position is probably as healthy as it's been in a really, really long time. The administration is aligned. I think the talent deficit that Texas had at one point when Tom Herman got here, I don't think that is as drastic as it once Agreed. Was.
It's not where it needs to be, but it's better.
It's much better. There's no doubt BK is right. The disconnect between the talent you're bringing in and the amount of draftable prospects going out, there's something missing there, and it is development. You got to get that. If you solve that, everything else will fall into place, in my mm-hmm. opinion. I think you'll get the wins, and I think you'll get the support, and I think all of that kind of stuff will fall into place. And CEC's done a really good job of making sure everything else is taken care of. The facilities, the, you know, promotion of the brand, the program, all that kind of stuff. Really, all Sark has got to do is win games. I'm not going to say the cake is baked, but at least the batter is already been prepared there for you, right?
Is the oven preheating?
The oven is preheating. There you go.
Preheat your oven.
Preheat the oven.
Dude, that bell rang years ago. We got the notification that the oven is ready, and it's hot years ago.
The light burned out.
I think
out.
You left yeah. the oven on, honey.
Yeah. We forgot to cook.
You forgot to cook.
Right.
Just turned on the oven and walked out. Come on.
Man, and I will also argue that Texas is doing fundamentally different. What? Texas is doing something fundamentally different with the hire of Steve Sarkisian versus the hires of Charlie Strong and Tom Herman. We know Sark's tenure at USC did not work out, but he had been a head coach at a big-time program.
Mm-hmm.
He got to see what it was like to be a coach at a big-time program. Tom Herman didn't have that, right? I know he was a coordinator at Ohio State, but his head coaching job was at Houston. Texas, a huge step up from Houston. Charlie Strong didn't have that. I know he was at Florida, but he wasn't a head coach there. And both of those guys coached under Urban Meyer, who's one of the best college football coaches of all time. Steve Sarkisian, to me, like the hire of him, hiring a coordinator, but also a guy who has experience coaching at a blue blood type of program, that is fundamentally different than just hiring the up-and-coming coach who is getting far and away his biggest job when he gets the job at the University yeah. of Texas. So I think it's a little bit different there, too. And that shows you that Texas is trying to exhaust different options to make sure that they get this one right. So basically, everything in this quote to me is wrong.
See, I don't think everything is. I'm more with Rod. I think it's the absolutist that it's 100%. I do think culturally there have been some issues here.
I do too.
Okay.
But what he's saying is all the problems are culturally, so I think that's wrong.
That's wrong.
Saying Texas is not doing anything fundamentally different, I think, is wrong. And saying Mack Brown is the only coach that can handle the issues that Texas presents, I think, is also wrong.
I agree. I guess my point is, I guess so it would be wrong because he's being absolute about it, but he does have a point. His issue is being absolute and saying it's 100% of the problem.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying about the Mack Brown thing, right? Mack Brown's the guy that could put the BBs in a box, unite the boosters, donors, fans, media, all alike. Tom Herman didn't do that, and it's hard to find a coach that could do that, all those things. Mack Brown ain't walking through that door. If Sark wins, all those other things will fall into place, and that's my concern. All right, I know people, I know he's valuing relationships, and that's great, and he's actually establishing a really good rapport with the Texas high school football coaches. I like that too, but he's got to win because all that stuff that he's, all that, you know, street cred that he's building up right now, all that goodwill that he's building right now, which is necessary, it will all disappear like that
quickly
if he doesn't win games.
Like Tom Herman, at least with the fan base, was building that. Now, behind the scenes, he wasn't.
Exactly. So, Mike, when I researched Sark and his time there at USC and at Washington, and by the way, Rick Neuhauser brought this up. Chip Brown talked to him, I believe, for his insider piece a couple of weeks ago. And Rick Neuhauser was a play caller himself, talked about being a play caller and a head coach. And he said, what made Sark special was the ability to call plays, but there were times at USC when calling the plays caused him to lose track of managing the clock. There was a game against Arizona State when he was still in his tempo mode instead of running time off the clock, and Todd Graham's Sun Devils beat him on a Hail Mary in 2014 on a play that never should have happened.
I remember that game.
There should have been no time left on the clock. He said, so with all the analysts you have at your disposal as a college head coach today, if he were listening to me, he would have someone who was helping him manage all those in-game situations. So I'm just saying that's just one thing, because you're a head coach and you're also the play caller. You're going to be the play caller. So that's one thing I worry about. That's just game management.
That is a great point. He was 46-35 as a head coach. So he's got a lot to prove as a head coach. And that's why I say, how much more of this new head coach, Steve Sarkisian, is going to be more what we saw, what he learned in Atlanta and Alabama, and less the guy who went 34-29 at Washington.
Well, life is easier there, right? Life is easy when you go to Atlanta and you inherit what was the number one offense in the NFL.
Right,
averaging
with the veteran
almost,
quarterback.
Almost 34 points a game. He was a damn MVP.
Yeah.
He was the MVP. The best wide receiver in the game, by the way.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying Sark was bad there. He actually was good. I mean, they were at number nine offense, but they scored 11.7 less points per game than they did in 2016 when Shannon was calling the plays, because he's elite, in my opinion. I'm not saying Sark's not elite, but he's not in that rarefied air. I don't think he's in that group. So he's good and great, but I don't think he's elite yet. He got better in 2018, only scored 8.7 less points per game than they did in 2016.
Right.
So it's easier to call plays when you're inheriting that, when you get to Alabama and you have access to the best roster in the history of college football with the best head coach in the history of college football. That's a lot of support. That's putting you in the best position to be successful. He's not going to have those advantages here at Texas. When he was calling the plays at USC and at Washington and also the head coach, his offense has never finished higher than 18th. That's great. That's pretty good. But he'll tell him Herman had a top seven offense here at Texas.
He was 31-26 at the two biggest programs in the Pac-12. 31-26
and by the way,
in conference.
He could never beat the best coaches in the Pac-12. Couldn't beat them.
No.
Couldn't be. 0-4 versus Chip Kelly. 0-2 for when he faced off against Harbaugh. He was 2-3 versus David Shaw. 1-2 versus Chris Peterson. 0-2 versus Les Miles. 1-1 versus Bruce Minino. 0-1 versus Pete Carroll. He couldn't beat the best coaches. The best coaches he beat were Mike Leach and Whittingham. Who, by the way, Tom Herman beat too. So my point is, we're going on faith here, because there's not a lot of evidence that he's been elite, and
now he's taken
this evolutionary transformation. No, he might be the same damn guy he was at Washington and USC, and we may not learn until he plays Louisiana or Oklahoma.
If that's the case, then it won't be a good hire. But I do think, and I think part of it is, BK, what he's learned just through his experience at USC, the more off-the-field stuff, that this guy is. And I also see it with his schemes. So his schemes actually look different than they did back then.
Yeah.
And that tells me that he's grown as a coach.
Yeah, hopefully he learned a lot from Nick Saban, right? Which college football coach has more members on a support staff than anybody in the country?
Nick Saban.
It's Nick Saban. Nick
Saban.
Hopefully the issue that you talked about, Rod, that plagued Sark at USC won't plague him here. Like, maybe he's learned, all right, I need guys on my coaching staff. I need more analysts on my coaching staff. I need a clock management guy to help me out with those things.
Right.
Tom Herman could have used one of those, right? How many times do we complain about clock management under Tom Herman? So hopefully Steve Sarkisian has
every
learned
other
those things. Yeah, we're talking about it with Chris Del Conte, right? And the athletic department as a whole, flexing their muscles, using their resources. You can do that if you're Texas. You can pay a bunch of analysts and a bunch of support staff members to be on Steve Sarkisian's staff to make life easier
for him.
Hopefully that's something that Texas does.
And Tom Herman started to do that, remember?
Yeah.
He brought on all the ex-head coaches. He had Coach Withers on the staff. What was the guy that came from North Carolina that went to Baylor, and he was the offensive coordinator last year?
Larry Fedora
was on the staff. I mean, he had guys. I was really excited about the guys that he was bringing in to be the analysts, and I don't think they ever really utilized those analysts very well.
Back to your point, though. There still were things that the program needed to do. You may not have made the right hires, or you may not have implemented them the right way, but you still at least started to go down that path of we're at least gonna have a room now where these people are.
Hey, when Tom Herman got here, Texas didn't have a support staff. They didn't have a personnel department essentially, because Mack Brown, God bless him, he was trying to basically fight against these the arms race of college football, where everybody's got a bigger support staff. And
he's your accountant that says, I'm not going to go through some of the tax cheats or the tax, what do you call them?
The loopholes or
loopholes.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, hey, it's legal.
It's legal.
Why are you being a nice guy to the government?
Exactly. Take what they can give them. One other thing I'm worried about with Sark is just, like I said, the more research I do on Sark, and particularly his scheme, as Katie's brought up, the higher I am on Sark. I will say that, because the scheme is, ideally, it's just really an explosive, and it's a perfect scheme for the Big 12. Yeah, and it has evolved, especially since he's got with Kyle Flood.
That's a great point.
They had this symbiotic relationship that has taken his offense to the next level. I will say that. It's a different offense than the one I watch when I watch his USC Washington offenses. Him and Kyle Flood together are doing great things. One thing I worry about, though, Nick Saban's assistants since he's been at Alabama that have gone on to become head coaches, there's a Belichickian quality to a lot of them. Kirby Smart's been the best, of course. But the reason I think Kirby Smart was the best of those assistants from Bama that went on to become head coaches is because he was with him so long. He was with him for like 11, 12 years. He was with Nick Saban. He actually learned everything he could from Nick Saban. Most of these guys, they don't learn a lot from Nick Saban. They're not there long enough.
They took over a program, too, that was winning 10 games
exactly,
a year. Or close to that.
The fruit, that's true, too. Good point. It wasn't that far off. The fruit is plucked a little bit too early from the tree before it's ripe from that Nick Saban coaching tree at times. And it reminds me of the Belichickian model. The reason that Belichick's coaching tree sucks, and it's notorious, everybody know how bad it is. And, you know, Nick Saban is the best from the coaching tree. But other than that, I mean, it's really, really bad. We know that Patricia and Josh McDaniels and Bill O'Brien is also in the category, because we know Bill Belichick is a very secretive guy. He's clandestine. He doesn't like to share. He doesn't even like to share with the media. This guy has a playbook that he doesn't even share with his own assistants. We still don't know why Malcolm Butler didn't start the Super Bowl. Neither does Tom freaking Brady. This guy, Spygate, they have a library, at least they had a library of illicit surveillance tapes that they had on other teams. He's a clandestine guy, right? Basically, the acronym for the three-letter acronym for the NFL with the Belichick, they're like the FBI, the CIA. But my point is, that's why his coaching tree sucks, too. You go look at Bill Walsh's coaching tree. It's an awesome coaching tree. Why? Bill Walsh wrote books. He used to speak at coaching. He used to speak at clinics all the time. He was a broadcaster at one time. Same thing with Bill Parcells. Loves the media. Wrote books. Loves to talk to the media. Loves to hold court, if you will. Loves to share a lot. That's why Belichick learned what he learned. And that's why Andy Reid's coaching tree, also really good, right? Andy Reid's very open. He wants to share with everybody. To have a good coaching tree, you have to be open. You have to be willing to share your secrets. Belichick does not share his secrets. Saban learned not to share secrets from Belichick. By the way, Saban has already said he hates that his coaching staffs continue our raided and poached year after year. And then they come stealing, the coaches who leave come steal more coaches from his staff. By the way, which Sark did. So that's why he shares even less with the coaches. So my point is, Sark doesn't know a lot from Saban. He doesn't share a lot with anybody. Go look at all these guys. Kirby Smart learned the most because he's winning for 11 years. He still can't beat him, which is why none of the assistants can beat him. None of them. Because he doesn't share everything with them.
Are you sure you're getting higher on Sark the more you research him?
That's all in the notes. I'm looking at the trend, though.
It's accurate. Those are facts.
Give me the really good coaching hire from Bama since he started this legendary run. Since he started this iconic run, which one of those coaches are really good? It's Kirby Smart. He's a really good one. Why? He was with him for 11 years.
Take your thoughts. 337-3776. Before we break for Rod's rant of the day, I've got to tell the people about audiovisual consultations. 87 days away from Texas Longhorn football, 87 days away from the first big college football Saturday. You have your TV setup done yet? Make sure you get it done within the next 3 months. AV Consultations can hook you up. They're the company that hooked me up with the 4TV setup that I have at my place. It's the man cave style feel that I always wanted growing up. And AV Consultations turned my dreams into reality. They can do the same for you, whether it's 4 TVs on a wall like I have, you just want a big screen for the living room with surround sound, how about a home theater room, something for your patio area, AV Consultations will take care of you. They're the best in the business, and they've been in business here in Central Texas since 1988. I promise you will not regret your phone call to Audio Visual Consultations. 512-255-8678. That's 512-255-8678, or check them out online. It's avconsultations.com. All right, Rod B., what's coming up next on your rant of the day?
All right, you guys know I'm obsessed with bank robberies and bank robbery stats. Well, Floyd Mayweather described his last exhibition as legalized bank robbery. We'll get into it, and we'll hear from Floyd Mayweather, and we'll talk about whether he's right. All of that and more in Rod's Rant of the Day right here on the Triple Option with RBKD right here on 104.9, 101.9, and AM 1260.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Find out what happens when people stop being polite and start getting real.
You ain't keeping it real.
My God, okay, it's happening. Everybody stay calm.
No, you've done it now. It's time for Rod's Rant of the Day.
Hold on to your butts.
Welcome back to the Triple Option with RBKD. Time for Rod's Rant of the Day. And I want to talk about the most recent exhibition boxing match between Floyd Mayweather and Logan Paul. For those who don't know, Logan Paul fought Floyd Mayweather over the weekend. Floyd Mayweather was guaranteed $10 million as just his upfront fee, as his as a part of his purse, and then 50% of the pay-per-view buys. We do have that number. I'll get to that in just a second. Logan Paul was guaranteed $250,000 plus 10% of the pay-per-view buys, so he's probably going to make a couple of million from it. If you didn't watch the fight, it wasn't worth it. It actually ended with boos from the crowd because the 8-round exhibition was that distasteful to boxing fans. Floyd Mayweather, I mean, they did actually keep up with the punch tally, but there were no judges, and you couldn't, basically no winner was declared, so you couldn't officially win the fight. I know. These exhibitions are getting sadder and sadder. They're sad, sad money grab. We'll get to that in a second. But for those who don't know, Logan Paul, the reason he's famous, he has 66 million followers on social media. He's a YouTuber.
Influencer.
He's an influencer. He was the heaviest fighter. This is kind of what they were doing to kind of pump up the fight. He's the heaviest fighter that Floyd Mayweather has ever fought, so there was some thought he could be the Great White Hope or the Great White Hype, and maybe try to knock out Floyd Mayweather. His first round, he did come out, and I think he tried to lay some haymakers down, but I don't think Floyd Mayweather was ever concerned. Then after that, Floyd Mayweather just kind of danced around and dominated the fight, but that's just what Floyd Mayweather would do. Like I said, it ended in boos. People did not like the fight. No official winner was declared. Mayweather, before the fight, estimated that he was going to make around somewhere from 50 to 100 million from the fight.
That's ridiculous.
That's what
I
he
hope
said.
This stuff ends.
He made 10 million up front. Now, the pay per view buys, they
We're
said
the consumers, just stop consuming.
In the United States alone, they said between 600,000 and 650,000 pay per view buys, which is not a lot, by the way. Remember when he famously fought, take it to the most recent exhibition fight between Mike Tyson and Roy Jones. Remember that one? That's kind of got this little celebrity boxing exhibition fight thing going. That happened. That was 1.6 million pay-per-view buys.
That was actually interesting to me.
And that was actually pretty interesting.
You know why?
And then they have Nate.
Because they're both boxers.
Yeah, it's true. Great point. Did they have Nate? Was that the one Nate Robinson was
on?
Yeah,
Nate Robinson against Cliff Paul.
Oh,
wasn't it Jake Paul?
No, it was the other Paul, wasn't it?
Yeah, not Cliff. Who's
Jake.
Cliff? Oh, Cliff's the State Farm guy. Actually, Chris. Oh, God.
I was like, Cliff
Paul. Once again, it comes back to commercials.
Full circle. And remember, famously, Mayweather-McGregor, which was probably the most famous exhibition bout in the history of combat sports, it got famously 4.3 million pay-per-view buys, to give you perspective. And by the way, that is the second highest pay-per-view buy for any combat event in pay-per-view history Floyd Mayweather Pacquiao is 4.6 million pay per views. That's number one.
Okay.
So, I mean, just it was not even in the same universe as some of these other exhibition fights we've seen. But if you do the math, I think $49.99 per pay per view buy still comes out just in the United States buys alone. We haven't done it international yet, so I assume that might add 50 to 100,000 pay per view buys too. You're still in the $32 million range.
For and that means an 8-round exhibition that got booed.
Got it booed. And Mayweather's going to get 50% of that. So let's just say he's going to get another $15 million on top of the $10 million. So he's going to make $25 million easy from the fight, maybe a little bit more than that. He thought it'd be between $50 and $100 million because I think he thought they'd get a much higher pay-per-view buy number. That's not the case. But Jake Paul gets 10%, so he's probably going to make $3 million. I mean, you got to pay the taxes off of it, but $3 million on top of your $250,000, he probably takes home, I don't know, $2 million from the fight after taxes.
That. Yeah.
So I think it's a win-win for those guys.
Yeah, I'll fight anyone for that amount of money.
Yeah.
Especially if I know I'm not getting knocked out and the other guy's not going to try that much.
Exactly. And I think, guys, this is why we got some sound we'll play from Money Mayweather here. And you just hit the nail on the head, BK. Because Money Mayweather knows he's not getting knocked out at all, and there's really no danger in some of these exhibitions. I guess Conor McGregor probably could have proposed a threat to him. That's why that was considered a real match. Okay, but still, Money Mayweather, who's considered one of the greatest defensive fighters in history, he's just playing defense. I say playing defense, but he's just boxing defensively.
Mm-hmm.
This is his retirement plan. He won't say it, but this is his retirement plan. So he's had three exhibition fights, Showman. I went back and did the numbers. It's a great retirement plan.
Because he's not really in danger.
You're not in danger. And he's not really having to train like his old
thing.
He's probably training a couple hours a day to stay in decent shape. It's 8-round, 3-minute round. He's good. So in the three exhibition fights he's had, guys, he fought overseas. He fought Tensha Nasakawa.
I think you nailed that.
And if I messed it up, I apologize.
No disrespect.
Yeah, no disrespect intended. He made $9 million from that fight that we know of. We didn't get all the details because it was overseas. He made $275 million reportedly from the McGregor fight.
You can't even read.
Yeah.
We got that gem from that fight.
Yeah, and by the way, McGregor.
Here's my question about his money guy.
McGregor made like $100 million from it. He made so much money from the fight, he can't even fight anymore. He's like, I made too much money to be fighting. Like, I'm just so rich.
Yeah, he didn't want to go back to the UFC because he barely makes any money there.
Yeah.
And he does one boxing match and he makes...
Yeah.
Nine figs.
I guarantee
you,
him
if you made $275 million, you don't need a retirement plan.
That's from an exhibition.
That's what I'm saying. What are you spending?
He made $275. We're going to start getting some Money Mayweather money facts sometimes because they're pretty fun, too. They're kind of like those you know, those facts I gave you about the Colombian drug lord.
Oh, that was fantastic.
Yeah. It's kind of like that. El Padron. Anyway, okay, so McGregor, remember, McGregor actually made $100 million from the fight. And what I love about the McGregor, this is why I think McGregor just decided to hang it up. You know, at one point, if you go back and look in 2013, Conor McGregor was still on unemployment, and now he made $100 million.
That's crazy.
He was on unemployment. He was making $215 on unemployment check.
Man,
in 2013.
I need to get on unemployment then.
Yeah. Well, no, but that was like when he was just fighting literally for his life. He was just fighting. But anyway, the retirement plan for Floyd. So he got $9 million, he got $275 million from the fight that he had with Conor McGregor. And then he got now another, I don't know, what we say, $25 to $30 million here. So guys, I mean, think about that. So $275, he's up to about $300, maybe $320 million in his three exhibition fights he's had since he retired. Here is Floyd Mayweather, because people are now starting to criticize him. We're like, dude, we think that you're hustling everybody. That
stop
you're,
buying the fight.
That you're fighting just for the payday. This is a cash grab for you. You're not worried about the entertainment value. You're not worried about what it's doing to the sport of boxing, if it's good for the sport or bad for the sport. It's a cash grab to you. Here is some cut up audio from the interview that he had right after that fight. Here is Money Mayweather.
And they say, well, it's not all about the money. Well, your kids can't eat legacy. The patches on my trunks, that's 30 million alone. So who's really the smartest one in the sport of boxing? If you guys don't want to see me do no exhibitions, don't come. Don't watch. When it comes to legalized bank robbing, I'm the best. I don't care if y'all write good stories. I don't care if y'all write bad stories. At the end of the day, I will always have a last laugh. Damn, I'm writing a story about Floyd. But look at the house I go to, and look at the house he go to. Then all the guys that y'all said was extraordinary, the Canelos and the Pacquiao's, I made them look ordinary. And then when I see it's a chance for me to do a heist, a quick heist. At the end of the day, I'm the smart one. He said, oh, Floyd don't look good like he used to look. My bank account looking better and better each and every day.
He's right.
He's not shying from it.
It's legalized. Exactly. He's saying, y'all the fools. Y'all keep paying for it. Y'all keep talking about it. Y'all know it's a sham fight.
That wasn't Garrett Cole. That was straight admission.
He's telling it like it is. And he's right. It's like that Broadway play, The Producers, right, where the accountant learns that you can make more money in a flop than you can in a hit.
Mm-hmm.
It all depends on how you sell it, the shares you sell of it. I believe it was, what's his name? Leopold Bloom. Did I get that right? Max Bialystok. You ever seen The Producers?
I have not.
Oh, sorry.
But you remember the premise.
I know
what you're talking about. I want to say there was a show that.
Yeah. Oh no, there've been movies about it. It's a famous play forever. But anyway, the whole premise of The Producers is you can make money off a flop. You can make more money off a flop if you sell it the right way. That's what essentially this is the producer's version of boxing.
Interesting.
He's like, I can make more money off the flop because in terms, if you consider time to be money, the time I spent training, all right, the time that I have to put into actually promoting the fight, I fight some YouTuber who has 66 million viewers and 66 million followers. I don't have to promote the fight. Mm-hmm. He'll promote the fight for me. And all of his minions will watch the fight. I can make the real boxing fans want to see it because they want to see anything that my name is on because they know that I am the premier name in boxing. As long as he brings his name, he'll bring the boxing crowd. But the boxing crowd is shrinking every day.
Yeah.
It's shrinking every day. What he knows is, the celebrity boxing crowd for that wants to watch some YouTuber have a chance to knock me out. Oh, that crowd's growing every day exponentially. And spending mama and daddy's money to go buy a pay-per-view fight. It's brilliant business and marketing. I can't even hate on it.
Yeah, nobody cares about boxing anymore.
No.
Everybody cares about celebrities. We've always cared about celebrities.
Ding, 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 ding.
So that's what boxing has become. The fans are showing it with their money. Boxers themselves are showing it. They're doing fights like these instead of fighting actual boxers. I mean, the sport of boxing has become this, and this is where the money is, and Floyd's always been about the money. He calls his team the money team.
Calls his team the money team.
This is who he's been forever, and he's found a way to. He might not be able to read, but he's found a way to cash in on this market right now, and it's genius.
Yeah, when historians look back and look at just how the society has devolved, it'll be stuff like that. You'd say, well, you don't care about the actual product. You just care about celebrities and glorifying them. But whose fault is that at the end of the day?
It's our fault.
It's consumers.
Yeah, we're watching it.
He just said that, which I'll give him credit for.
Yeah.
And what did I say right before you played that clip? Don't buy it.
Don't buy it. Don't hate the player. Hate the game.
And hate yourself if you're the one who's
if you're
creating
it. Yeah.
If you paid for that fight and you're complaining about anything,
stop.
Shame on you.
Nobody at this station paid for it. I believe Snoop may have been the only one who actually he went to a fight party, so he paid to get into the party.
Okay.
But I don't think anybody here paid for it, so God, I think we have smart sports broadcasters here at least. Because it's a straight-up hustle. It is. And listen, you guys know I'm obsessed with bank robberies. I've always been obsessed. Every year I check the FBI bank robbery stats. They're fascinating to me.
What's buried in your backyard?
Yeah, in 2019, by the way, 2,405 bank robberies. On average, they got away with $4,213 per offense. And good news for law enforcement, the bank robbery clearance rate is actually going up. They're closing more of the cases.
Oh, okay.
They don't close them all in the same year because they say it takes years sometimes to solve these bank robbery cases.
Well, they show with all the video and surveillance we have now, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. They say it's technology that's helping them solve more bank robberies.
It's much harder to be a criminal now than it was
post 9/11,
30 years ago.
In terms of you getting away on different streets and knowing where you go because of the cameras and everything, it's just getting harder
track
to get away.
That.
Yeah, it's getting harder to get away with that kind of stuff. But anyway, usually the clearance rate was 50 to 60%. Now it's hovering closer to 70%+ for bank robberies. And they still only recover like 40 to 50% of the funds, which is fascinating to me. So they just go hide the money somewhere, even when they get caught. But I digress. The reason that people rob banks, the studies that I have done, the psychological studies on it are fascinating too, because they said that a lot of the bank robbers are the ones who get caught. They're serial offenders.
Mm-hmm.
They're robbing like their third or fourth bank.
Yeah.
And it's like, dude, why don't you just rob one bank and you're cool? Well, the reason, because they only get $4,000 per bank robbery, they got to go out there again because they're an idiot. For them, the people who are robbing these banks, the reward outweighs the risk. For most of us, it's like, hell no, I'm not robbing the bank because the risk doesn't outweigh the reward to me. But for them, the reward outweighs the risk of them getting caught. And for Floyd, that's what's happening here. The reward of doing this outweighs the risk. There's no risk for him.
Mm-hmm.
What's the risk? He's going to get knocked out by these guys and blemish his record? No. Is he going to get hurt by one of these people? No. There's no winner declared. It's only 8 rounds. There's no point system officially. He can't lose.
Yeah, the quote-unquote risk would be his reputation, and he doesn't care about that at all.
He doesn't care about
that. He cares about the money.
He cares about the money.
About that. Your kids can't eat legacy. What a line.
It's a great line.
Money.
Legalized bank robbery.
Mm.
It's a great line.
That's what fired you
up. It's a great
up.
Analogy. It was.
Good really stuff. Was. Rod's rant of the day. Floyd Money Mayweather continuing to live up to his nickname, making a ton of money for fighting YouTube stars, and we keep paying for it.
I know.
Not the three of us, but
no.
We as a society keep paying for it.
Where are we at in society today?
Yeah, I don't know, Coach. I don't know.
Not good, Coach.
It's the triple option with RBKD.
Get that haircut, too. You're not helping.
No, yeah. I like the mullet. I hope that doesn't go away. I'm glad he's rocking that thing. It's the triple option with RBKD. When we come back, we'll have Off the Record 2. A California nun may have done enough to convince me to become Catholic. I'll tell you what she did next. Back here on the Triple Option with RBKD.
Deacon, yeah.
That was a nice deke.
I'm that shortstop that puts the tag down and the ball's in right center field.
Mm. Little hidden ball trick, perhaps?
We actually came up on that anniversary, Wichita State, Miami. Omaha.
The national title game, right?
I don't think that was a national.
Okay.
It may have been. Actually, you know what? You may be right about that.
I don't know. Welcome back to the show.
I was too young.
Coming up in about 12 minutes. Hey, some people might think the hidden ball trick is cheating. whatever Garrett Cole is doing...
Yeah.
He's probably cheating. And he might have given the worst press conference answer in sports history yesterday. We'll play that audio for you coming up in about 12 minutes. It's hilarious and awful at the same time. Some would call it hilariously awful. Garrett Cole.
It's cringeworthy.
Basically pled guilty without pleading guilty.
I haven't heard it, actually.
Oh, man.
I'm not going to wait. I'm just going to wait then.
You got to hear it.
Because I haven't heard it. I've seen it online, but I hadn't heard it.
It's special.
Okay.
It really is. And we also have some audio from the fan in New York where they are just blasting Garrett Cole. Like even Yankee fans are mad at Garrett Cole for the way he handled this press conference. So that's coming up. Obviously a big cheating scandal in baseball. Believe it or not. That'd be the first time we've ever had cheating and baseball mentioned in the same sentence.
And a gray area of cheating, too.
Yeah, but we'll get into that and also play some audio from some of my favorite interviews in sports history. But how about this for Off the Record, too, gentlemen? Y'all know I'm Jewish. I'm proud of being Jewish. I didn't have any anticipation of converting.
Mm.
But a California nun...
I'm converting to y'all.
I'd be changing my mind. Jewish people?
Yes.
Judaism. Purely for the jokes.
You can't do that.
For the jokes and the days off.
The jokes and the vacation days.
I think y'all are funny people. A couple more built-in days off.
The days off are better. I can tell you that.
Than the jokes?
The jokes
y'all
are solid.
Y'all have had some funny people. Come on.
The days off are awesome. Yeah. Especially when you work here and nobody else is Jewish, so you can just make up holidays.
You do. I know you do.
Yeah. Nobody will even Google it.
No, it's like against the law to discriminate.
You do know we have other Jewish friends, right?
Yeah,
we can call them.
I don't have a ton.
Yet.
Yeah, as I was saying, I don't have a ton.
Yeah.
I need more.
Yeah.
Obviously.
So how about this? A California nun will plead guilty to swindling more than $800,000 from a Catholic elementary school that she ran.
Oh, wow.
And why did she swindle all of this money?
Because she's not a good person.
Well, that's
obvious.
That's part of it. She needed help paying for her gambling trips.
So now you're down. Now BK, that's why I'm down. Yeah, and now BK goes, that doesn't mean she's not a bad person. Then.
Sister Mary Margaret Krupper, 79.
Unbelievable.
What the hell is she gambling on?
Was charged Tuesday with wire fraud and money laundering for ripping off St. James Catholic School for a period of 10 years.
Unbelievable.
From 2008 to 2018. That's according to a press release from the U.S. Attorney's Office in California. This woman, this sister, not sister, but sister.
She a nun?
She's a nun.
She's a nun. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She was the principal of this school for 28 years.
Mm.
She agreed to plead guilty as part of the deal with prosecutors. She used her position to funnel $835,000 of the school's funds to, quote, pay for expenses that the order would not have approved.
Also, yeah, because it was for her gambling problem.
Think she was going to get away with that?
She did for 10 years.
Yeah.
Got away with it for 10 years.
Yes, she thinks she's got God on her side.
Paid for large gambling expenses incurred at casinos and also certain credit card charges as well.
How much at a time?
We don't have the details there.
And over what period of time?
So 10 years, $835,000. So $80K a year if we're going on average?
Yes, I'm saying that because obviously she was taking it out piecemeal. I wonder how slowly she took it
out. So she was in charge of everything as the principal of this school.
So she had nobody to check her anyway.
No, she was overseeing tuition money.
Oh, yeah.
She oversought. One of those three has to be right. Fees that the school received, also charitable donations. She oversaw all of that. And she controlled the school's credit union accounts,
which
she used to divert other funds that she would, in turn, use.
How did she get caught
spending?
Then? I wonder why she got caught. If she's the only one in charge of all that with no regulation or checks and balances, how did she get caught? Did she?
TikTok in Vegas.
Because it seems like the scheme would have been just lie about the money coming in.
Right.
Take the money off the top. You're that person. Just steal off the top.
Yeah.
Meet it when it comes in.
If there is no oversight and no one can see the book, say, hey, look, we just didn't bring in as much.
Exactly.
You guys aren't as charitable as I thought.
It's exactly right.
And that's the saddest thing about this stuff whenever there's clergymen or women that are stealing. Because, the people that are giving are good people.
Yeah.
They're really good people. And their heart's in the right place. And they're trusting you. They have faith, ironically, in you. And you pull this crap. Which is also why I think whether it's cops or clergymen or, hell, we talk about Little League coaches. Little League coaches may be a little bit of a stretch there. But people that you should trust and there's a built-in trust, they should get hammered more whenever you find out that they're scoundrels like this.
Agreed.
I assume she's going to jail for a long time.
For the rest of her life.
We're still very early on in this process, it sounds like. But she also admitted to falsifying the school's financial records, which comes as no surprise.
No.
Due to be arraigned on July 1st.
What was her game of choice? What was the game of chance of choice, I should say?
I want to know,
what was she into? Was she going to the casino?
If she was playing craps, does that make her a holy roller?
Well done.
Had to be done.
That
might be worth ending on a high note right there. That might be
solid work.
We're not going to do better than that.
No,
I think we may
end
it. That might be the high note.
Yeah, and we had a nun on the run for 10 years.
And we had a nun on the run.
Nun on the run.
I think that's all I've got. Oh, anymore.
She'll be back
one more
tomorrow.
Trio?
Well, she's a hero, first of all.
No, she's not a hero.
She deserves some love.
No, she doesn't.
It's impressive.
No, she doesn't.
Not at all.
I'm a fan of...
She's a horrible person.
Yeah.
It's not the first time this has happened, also. I remember a story a couple of years ago where a couple of nuns at one of these schools swindled $500K to use for casino trips, too.
Nuns.
Check your nuns.
Yeah.
Check your nuns.
Some background work on these nuns.
Check your nuns before you wreck your nuns. I think Ice Cube's,
no,
it wasn't him.
2 out of 3 ain't bad.
It's a great batting average.
2 out of 3 ain't bad.
We'll take it. There's Off the Record 2 here on the Triple Option with RBKD. Coming up next, Garrett Cole, the former Astro, now New York Yankee, had the worst press conference answer in sports history. He was basically asked point blank if he's ever cheated. And, come back to find out what he said. It's hilarious, and it's awful, and it's next.